You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for today's reading of the Greeley Tribune. Today is Tuesday, January 20th, 2026. My name is Mike Fearberg. Here are some of the stories we're going to be reading for you this hour. First new fossils in more than 100 years discovered at Colorado's Dinosaur National Monument. Tina Peters grabs and shoves a fellow inmate in a brief scuffle, video shows. A federal judge denies a challenge by Representatives Joe Neguse and Jason Crow to the latest ICE detention visits policy. Vacant homes could be taxed in Colorado to pay for affordable housing under a lawmaker's proposal. Windsor water, sewer, and stormwater rates are going to increase by 26%. And a federal judge recommends dismissal of a lawsuit by Colorado school districts over transgender athletes. Our top story in the Greeley Tribune this Tuesday, the first new fossils in more than 100 years were discovered at Colorado's Dinosaur National Monument. Parking lot construction at Colorado's Dinosaur National Monument unearthed new fossils last fall, the first discovery at the monument in more than 100 years, according to the National Park Service. Monument staff discovered the fossils, which likely belong to the Diplodocus, a large long-necked dinosaur, on September 16th near the quarry exhibit hall, according to a news release from the Park Service. Asphalt removal during construction exposed dinosaur-bearing sandstone. The quarry exhibit hall, also known as the Wall of Bones, showcases roughly 1,500 dinosaur bones from the late Jurassic period. Some of them date back 150 million years, according to the Park Service. Roughly 3,000 pounds of fossils and rock were removed from the site near the exhibit hall between September and October, park officials said in the release. Scientists at the Utah Fieldhouse of Natural History State Park Museum are now working to clean and study the remains. The work can be viewed in the museum's fossil preparation lab, Park Service officials said. Some fossils from the excavation are already on display at the museum and in the quarry exhibition hall. This location has not been excavated for fossils since the original excavations at the site ended in 1924, National Park Service officials said in the release. Historic excavations were led by the Carnegie Museum from 1909 to 1922, the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in 1923, and the University of Utah in 1924. Dinosaur National Monument was established in 1915. Construction was paused after the fossils were discovered to allow paleontologists to assess and remove the fossils. The project was finished following the excavation, according to the release. Dinosaur National Monument sits on the edge of northwest Colorado and northeast Utah. Tina Peters grabs and shoves a fellow inmate in a brief scuffle, video shows. Tina Peters grabbed another inmate's neck and shoved her during a brief prison scuffle Sunday night, according to surveillance footage that appears to contradict claims from Peters' defense attorney. The footage obtained last night by the Denver Post shows Peters, an ally of President Donald Trump and former Mesa County clerk, maneuvering a large cart toward a closet through an open room. Peters then enters the closet with the cart at the closet's entrance. Another inmate, who appears to be carrying cleaning supplies, then enters the frame and appears to try to move the cart away from the closet door. As the other woman moves the cart aside, Peters then emerges from the closet, grabbing the woman and shoving her into the middle of the room. Peters has one hand on the woman's neck and another on her right arm, the video shows. The two then seem to exchange words, and Peters shoves her away. Peters is obscured from video footage when the scuffle first starts. The other inmate is visible throughout most of the incident, save for a brief moment where part of her right arm is obscured by the closet door. Both women later walked down a hallway. The video was provided to the Post in response to a public records request. In a statement last night, State Corrections Department spokeswoman Alondra Gonzalez-Garcia confirmed that Peters was involved in an incident with another inmate Sunday night. No one was injured, she wrote. No one has been charged as a result of the scuffle, and Peters was moved to a different housing unit in the prison. Neither inmate was placed in solitary confinement, which is not utilized in that facility, Gonzalez-Garcia wrote. The department is still investigating, she said. The video and the department statement seemed to contradict claims from Peters' supporters and the defense team, who alleged in a news release that the former clerk was assaulted in the closet and that she now faces criminal charges as the result. One of Peters' attorneys, Peter Ticton, told Trump ally Steve Bannon on Monday that Peters was attacked from behind. Ticton did not immediately respond to an email sent last night. Peters was sentenced to a combined 9 years in jail and prison in October of 2024. She was convicted of several crimes after she provided a third-party access to Mesa County's election systems. Her incarceration has become a cause célèbre for Trump and conservative allies who allege that Peters was wrongfully convicted. Trump, who issued a legally dubious federal pardon for Peters late last year, has repeatedly demanded that Colorado and Governor Jared Polis release her. Peters is appealing her conviction, and a state appeals court signaled some skepticism about the length of her sentence last week. Polis has said he is considering a request to release Peters or alter her sentence. He has called her sentence harsh and unusual. Pressed by reporters last week, he refused to say if he has discussed the case with the Trump administration. He denied that he had discussed releasing her as part of a trade for restored federal funding or other considerations. Several state officials, including Attorney General Phil Weiser, Secretary of State Jenna Griswold, and a group of county clerks, have asked him to leave Peters' sentence in place. A copy of Peters' inmate file, also obtained through a records request, shows she had a mixed first year in prison. Between April and July of 2025, she received four write-ups, prompting prison officials to reject her application for a special unit. Parts of the file are redacted, though visible negative write-ups appear to be related to minor issues like loitering or hiding. She told prison staff in August that she would soon be released, according to the file. In December, after officials told her she would not be released to visit her mother in the hospital, she said she planned to have negative things about the prison plastered all over social media. Federal judge denies a challenge by Representatives Joe Neguse and Jason Crow to the latest ICE detention visits policy. A federal judge declined on Monday to block a new federal policy limiting congressional visits to detention centers, rejecting an attempt by two Colorado lawmakers to challenge the Trump administration's latest attempt to restrict oversight of the facilities. The ruling from U.S. District Court Judge Gia M. Cobb is a win for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The agency has tried for months to require that members of Congress provide 7 days' notice before visiting ICE detention centers, heading off unannounced oversight visits. The decision means that members of Congress must again give that advance notice before trying to inspect the facilities, which likely include the detention center in Aurora. In December, the Washington, D.C.-based Cobb ruled that a prior version of the policy appeared to be unlawful, siding with Colorado's U.S. Representatives Joe Neguse and Jason Crow. She temporarily blocked the requirement and found that ICE's notice requirement violated a provision added to a funding bill several years ago. ICE reestablished the visitation policy earlier this month. Neguse, Crow, and 10 other congressional Democrats from other states then asked Cobb to weigh in on the new requirement last week after three lawmakers were denied access to a Minnesota facility. In court filings, the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE, argued it wasn't implementing the policy using the prior federal funding that included the notice requirement under law. Instead, officials told Cobb they would use funds from the tax and spend bill passed by Congress and signed by President Trump in July. The law included tens of billions of dollars in new funding for ICE. Cobb wrote that she wasn't necessarily finding that the newly established requirement was lawful, but she said lawmakers' lawsuit was not the proper way to challenge it. While she noted that ICE's new directive leaned on new funding, she said that her December order, blocking the first ICE policy, did not purport to address all future DHS policies which may implicate congressional access to detention centers. She told the Democratic lawmakers they could file a new suit or amend their existing one and seek a temporary block on the new policy. In a statement, Neguse's office said lawmakers were still reviewing the order and may pursue additional litigation. Vacant homes could be taxed in Colorado to pay for affordable housing under a lawmaker's proposal. Homes that sit empty throughout the year could be taxed by local governments in Colorado to help pay for affordable housing under a new bill being proposed by state lawmakers. House Bill 36 would allow county, city, and town governments to ask voters whether to impose an excise or property tax, or both, on homes that the government deems vacant. The measure is sponsored by Representatives Elizabeth Velasco, a Democrat from Glenwood Springs, and Brianna Titone, a Democrat from Arvada. The idea has been in the works for some time. Local governments had been pushing for a vacancy tax bill to be introduced during last year's legislative session, but no legislation ever came forward. One of the issues that we have is that there's not enough housing stock, but also, how I explain it to people, is that there is unlimited demand on our communities, Velasco said. People want to live there. People want to recreate there, but it's not affordable for people that are actually locals, that work there, that raise their families there. In the town of Windsor, water, sewer, and stormwater rates are going to increase by 26%. Starting February 1st, Windsor's water, sewer, and stormwater rates will increase to $126 for the average family home to cover the cost of upgrades to the town's water system. The 26% rate increase is the sharpest the town has implemented in 10 years, with the 2025 rate only 11% higher than the prior year. Windsor staff say this increase is driven by two primary factors: the Windsor Wastewater Treatment Facility upgrade and the 15th Street water line replacement. The current wastewater treatment facility is more than 30 years old and nearing the end of its service life, according to the town news release. To remain compliant with federal water standards, the town will need to decommission the current facility and build a new 4.2 million gallons per day facility, which is estimated to cost $150 million. These projects are investments we must make now so that our system continues to serve the community well into the future, Town Manager Shane Hale said in the release. No one welcomes higher bills, and we do not take this decision lightly. At the same time, we have a responsibility to keep Windsor's water and wastewater systems safe, reliable, and in compliance with state and federal standards. The 15th Street waterline replacement is also a priority for the town, given the pipe's age and its role as a critical service line for a significant portion of the water system. This project became urgent when the existing waterline continued to experience line breaks and leaks. Town staff estimates the project will cost $6.5 million. The rate increase and the projects are funded through the town's enterprise funds and are not funded by resident taxes, Hale added. An enterprise fund works like a business within the town where customers pay for the services they use, and those payments can only be used to run, maintain, and improve the utility system. Under the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, enterprise must be funded through the rates paid by the customers who use them, not through general tax dollars. Due to these legal requirements, the new wastewater facility and the 15th Street waterline replacement must be funded primarily through utility rates. However, the town will provide tools for residents to help lower their monthly bills. The town will provide free water audits to identify leaks and other issues, and will also share water-saving tips to reduce water use. We recognize that a 26% increase is significant, especially for residents on fixed or limited incomes, Hale said in the release. If you're worried about how these changes might affect you, please reach out. We want residents to understand why the rates are changing and what we're doing to support them. Our goal is to keep Windsor's water system strong, reliable, and ready for the future. For more information on the utility rate increases, you can go to windsorgov.com/utility rates. That's windsorgov.com/utility rates. A federal judge recommends dismissal of a lawsuit by Colorado school districts over transgender athletes. A judge recommended dismissing a federal lawsuit brought by several Colorado school districts that challenged the state's anti-discrimination law on grounds that it violates student rights by allowing transgender youth to play on school sports teams that match their gender identity. The January 13th recommendation by U.S. Magistrate Judge Maritza Dominguez-Braswell is a tentative win for state officials and a loss for the eight plaintiffs, which include four school districts, three charter schools, and one public education cooperative. A federal district court judge will now review the recommendation and make a final decision. The lawsuit was spearheaded last spring by conservative-leaning District 49 near Colorado Springs after its school board passed a policy banning transgender girls from girls' sports teams and transgender boys from boys' sports teams. The recommendation came the same day that the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in cases brought by two transgender athletes who oppose state laws barring transgender athletes from girls' and women's teams. The High Court's conservative-leaning majority seemed open to upholding the state laws, according to national news outlets, but how broad or narrow such a ruling would be remains to be seen. One of the defendants in the Colorado case, the Colorado High School Activities Association, settled with the districts and charter schools in early December. Dominguez-Braswell's recommendation, even if it is affirmed by a district court judge, may not have much effect on high school sports in Colorado because it does not directly weigh in on the legitimacy of policies that ban transgender students from joining sports teams that match their gender identity. Rather, it says the districts and schools that filed the lawsuit do not have the standing to sue the state on their own behalf or to sue on behalf of their students. Michael Francisco, an attorney with the law firm First and 14th, which is representing the plaintiffs, said he disagrees with Dominguez-Braswell's recommendations and looks forward to filing objections with the district court soon. This recommendation will not alter the course of this case or deter us from continuing this litigation to ensure every district in Colorado has the freedom to protect girls' sports, safeguard student privacy, and uphold the spirit of Title IX, he said in an emailed statement. A spokesperson for the Colorado Attorney General's office declined to comment. A number of Colorado districts have policies that allow transgender students to join sports teams consistent with their gender identity. Others make decisions on a case-by-case basis. Some, including the districts and schools that sued, recently passed policies barring transgender students from playing on teams that match their gender identity. In their lawsuit, the districts argued that the state's anti-discrimination law, which includes protections for transgender people, put the districts in an untenable position because they risk state penalties over their transgender athlete policies. In her recommendation, Dominguez-Braswell said settled legal principles prohibit the districts from bringing claims against the state based on the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. She also took issue with the plaintiff's claim to represent the interests of all district students. The plaintiffs brought two of their claims on behalf of all students, she noted, but their interests do not align with all students. She said the district's policies barring transgender students from certain sports teams cut against the interests of transgender students and may also cut against the interests of students who seek inclusivity in school-sponsored activities. In addition to the 26,000 student District 49, the plaintiffs include Colorado Springs 11, Academy 20, Montezuma Cortez, James Irwin Charter Schools, Monument Academy, the Classical Academy, and Education Re-envisioned Board of Cooperative Education Services. The defendants in the case were Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser, the Colorado Civil Rights Division, and the Colorado High School Activities Association. When the district settled with Colorado High School Activities Association in early December, the association agreed not to sanction plaintiff schools or teams over their transgender athlete policies. The settlement also required the plaintiffs to pay the Activities Association $60,000. The association's bylaws for years recognized the rights of transgender athletes to participate on sports teams that match their gender identity and stated that the group can review district decisions on such matters. But after the group had never penalized a school or district for policies on transgender athletes or dictated what those policies should say, an association spokesperson said in December. In other news, a 14-year-old Greeley West High School student faces charges after reportedly making threats against a teacher and a principal last week. The student who made the threats, who is not being identified because they're a minor, has been charged with interference with an educational institution. The Greeley Police Department began investigating the threats Monday afternoon after school administrators learned about the threats and alerted police, according to a Greeley PD news release. Because of the threats, the high school had increased police presence later last week. Based on a preliminary investigation, the threats against the teacher and principal were initially reported by a student who overheard the remarks. Several safe-to-tell reports also reported a shooting was planned for Tuesday, according to the release. Police confirmed the student who made the threat does not have access to guns, and School District 6 officials confirmed the student was not on campus Tuesday. Officials also said the student will face school disciplinary actions. If you have information about the threats, you can contact Greeley Police Sergeant Kevin Clary at kevin.clary, that's C-L-A-R-E-Y, at greeleypd.com. Suspect arrested in stabbing of ex-girlfriend that left her in critical condition. A man who is suspected of stabbing his ex-girlfriend more than 16 times earlier this month was arrested last Wednesday morning. The charges David Anthony Rios, age 48, faces for allegedly stabbing his ex-girlfriend and the location where he was arrested were not included in the Greeley Police Department news release. The woman, aged 44, escaped to a neighbor's house after the January 4th attack, where Rios followed her before he fled, according to the January 7th news release. The woman was found to have been stabbed at least 16 times, was taken to a hospital, and was in stable but critical condition. The woman's brother also was injured when he tried to intervene in the attack, according to the release. Rios's car was found abandoned on the 1300 block of 4th Street after the attack. A further update on the woman's medical condition was not available. In business news, the markets are having one of their worst days in several months. As Wall Street slumps, European stocks sink because Trump is threatening tariffs on 8 NATO members. Stocks slumped in morning trading on Wall Street today after President Trump threatened to hit 8 NATO members with new tariffs as tensions escalate over his attempts to assert American control over Greenland. About 2.5 hours into the trading day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 1.16% or 570 points. The S&P 500 is down 1.25% or 87 points. And the NASDAQ Composite is the worst of all, down 1.37% or 322 points. Losses in the market were widespread and led by technology stocks, many of which already have more influence over the direction of the market because of outsized values. Retailers, banks, and industrial companies also fell sharply. NVIDIA, one of the most valuable companies in the world, was down 3%. Amazon, down 2%. JP Morgan Chase, down 0.6%. The energy sector eked out gains as the price of U.S. crude oil was up, to $60 a barrel. The price of Brent crude, the international standard, was up 1.1% to $64.69. European markets and markets in Asia also fell. Trump said Saturday he would charge a 10% import tax starting February 1st on goods from Denmark, Norway, Sweden, France, Germany, the UK, the Netherlands, and Finland. The annual combined imports from European Union nations are greater than those from the top two biggest individual importers into the U.S., Mexico, and China. Gold prices surged 3%. Silver prices were up 5.5%, both reaching four records. The trade tensions apparently short-circuited a recent rally in Bitcoin. The cryptocurrency rose above $96,000 late last week, but has now dropped back to around $90,000. Treasury yields were mixed in the bond market. The yield on the 10-year Treasury was up to 4.27% from 4.23% late Friday. The yield on the 2-year Treasury fell to 3.59% from 3.60% late Friday. Trump linked his aggressive stance on Greenland to last year's decision not to award him the Nobel Peace Prize, telling Norway's prime minister that he no longer felt an obligation to think purely of peace in a text message released yesterday. Trump's message to Jonas Gahr Støre appeared to ratchet up a standoff between Washington and its closest allies over his threats to take over Greenland, a self-governing territory of NATO member Denmark. Trump's threats have sparked outrage and a flurry of diplomatic activity across Europe as leaders consider possible countermeasures, including retaliatory tariffs and the first ever use of the European Union's anti-coercion instrument. The Fed and Wall Street get another update on inflation this Thursday when the government releases the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, or PCE. That is the Fed's preferred measure for inflation in the United States. The Fed will meet next week for its policy meeting on interest rates. Wall Street is betting the central bank will hold its benchmark interest rates steady. Netflix intensifies its bid for Warner Brothers, making its $72 billion offer for the company all cash. Netflix is now offering to buy Warner Brothers Discovery studio and streaming business in all cash. It's an effort to win over the Hollywood giant shareholders for its $72 billion merger and potentially thwart a hostile bid from Skydance-owned Paramount. Back in December, Netflix struck a cash and stock deal with Warner valued at $27.75 a share, giving it a total enterprise value of $82.7 billion, including debt. But on Tuesday, the companies announced that they would be revising the transaction to simplify its structure, provide more certainty of value for Warner shareholders, and speed up the path to a shareholder vote, which they said could arrive by April. The all-cash transaction is still valued at $27.75 per Warner share. Warner stockholders will also receive the additional value of shares of Discovery Global, which would become a separate public company following a previously announced separation from Warner Brothers. Warner leadership has repeatedly backed a merger with Netflix, and the boards of both companies approved the all-cash deal announced today. In a statement, Warner CEO David Zaslav said the revised agreement brings us even closer to combining two of the greatest storytelling companies in the world. A spokesperson for Paramount declined to comment when reached by the Associated Press today. Unlike Netflix, Paramount wants to acquire Warner's entire company, including networks like CNN and Discovery, and went straight to shareholders with an all-cash $77.9 billion offer last month. Warner stockholders have until 5 p.m. Eastern Time Wednesday to tender their shares in support of Paramount's bid, which has an enterprise value of $108 billion, including debt. But that deadline could be pushed back further. While Paramount declined to share further details today, the Wall Street Journal reported last week the company was planning on another extension. Beyond its tender offer, Paramount has promised a proxy fight. Last week, the company said it would nominate its own slate of directors before the Warner's next shareholder meeting, the date of which has still not been set. Paramount also filed a suit in Delaware Chancery Court seeking to compel Warner Brothers to disclose to shareholders how it values its bid and the competing offer from Netflix. But a judge on Thursday denied Paramount's request to expedite that proceeding. In a statement at the time, Warner applauded the court's decision and called Paramount's lawsuit yet another unserious attempt to distract. Paramount, meanwhile, maintained that the ruling wasn't about the merits of the allegation and said Warner's shareholders should ask why their board is working so hard to hide this information. Regardless of who eventually wins the upper hand, a Warner Brothers Discovery sale could be a long, drawn-out process that is all but certain to attract tremendous antitrust scrutiny. On Tuesday, that is today, Netflix and Warner maintained that they expect to close on a merger 12 to 18 months from the agreement they came to last December. Still, Paramount's hostile bid could complicate the timeline. Politics are also expected to come into play under President Donald Trump, who has made unprecedented suggestions about his personal involvement on whether a deal will go through. Trade groups across the media and entertainment industry have sounded the alarm over both bids, warning that further consolidation in the industry could result in job losses and less diversity in content, with particularly negative consequences for filmmaking. The companies have spoken on those concerns. Today, Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos said combining with Warner will deliver broader choice and greater value to audiences worldwide, both at home and in theaters, while driving job creation and long-term industry growth. Netflix stock inched up just under 1% this morning. Shares of Warner Brothers Discovery and Paramount Skydance were slightly lower. Now from the Associated Press, here's a story of consumer interest. Beware of online ads with elaborate backstories. They may not be from a real small business. Malia and Company appears to be a small family-run business. The sweaters on its website feature a photo of a woman hand-knitting a Christmas design. The caption says, after decades of creating knitwear that tells quiet stories of care and beauty, she is closing her little studio and the pieces on offer are her last. The website of Olivia Westwood Boutique also spotlights a charming backstory. The About Us section says a twin sisters ran the shop that their mother opened in 1972 and share her commitment to a business rooted in family, community, and women uplifting women. Shoppers could take advantage of a sale honoring the boutique's late founder on what would have been her 95th birthday. But neither store is what it appears. Both display many of the same Icelandic, Nordic, and festive sweaters with identical stock images. Their website domains were registered in China in November ahead of the holiday shopping season. Negative reviews of both proliferate on consumer review websites like Trustpilot, where users report receiving shoddy goods that were difficult to return. Malia and Company did not return a request for more information about the owners. A close look at a pop-up ad describing Nola Rene, the 72-year-old Swedish knitter who is supposedly hanging up her knitting needles, reveals the word advertorial at the top and at the bottom, a disclaimer saying the people in the photos are models. At least three other shopping sites also sell the sweaters, lovingly hand-knitted in small batches. Olivia Westwood Boutique responded to an email query about where it was based and who owned the business by saying it was an online boutique, working with trusted global fulfillment partners to serve our customers. Online shopping scams are not unusual. About 36% of Americans failed to receive refunds after purchasing an item online that they said never arrived or turned out to be counterfeit, according to a Pew Research Center survey conducted last April and published in July. Faster and more sophisticated digital tools are only making it even harder for consumers to spot if what they're seeing is too good to be true. Some vendors and fraudsters have taken advantage of AI-generated images to create websites that have an aura of artisan authenticity or that point to a long history as a trusted small retailer, said Seth Keetron, a marketing professor at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's getting more and more common, Keetron said. If you're not careful or you're not really paying close attention or you don't really even know what to look for or what AI photos look like, it's easy to kind of just gloss over and miss that's probably not real. Misleading e-commerce ads often pop up on social media feeds or appear as banners on other kinds of websites. Experts say there are some simple steps shoppers can take to distinguish a legitimate small merchant from a suspicious one before they click on the buy button. Deanna Newman owns C'est La Vie, an online jewelry retailer in Ontario, Canada, and learned about mall business impersonation scams the hard way. A person claiming to have received low-quality goods from her site left an irate comment on Newman's Facebook page. Alarmed, she looked, but she could not find a record of that order. Newman concluded a scammer was using the name of her store for several shopping sites selling jewelry. When people went online to complain about inferior products, they landed on her site. There were C'est La Vie websites claiming to have brick-and-mortar locations in New York, Birmingham, England, Dublin, Ireland, and other cities, none of which actually exist. Sometimes people were receiving products from China and very low-grade jewelry, and some people weren't getting anything at all, Newman said. She dealt with the complaints, put a warning on her Facebook page and online shop about the misleading C'est La Vie websites, and posted videos on Instagram and TikTok to demonstrate she was a real person with a real business. Some of the copycat sites were taken down, but an influx of poor reviews and complaints nonetheless hurt her sales, she said. Including fake hardship stories along with ads is one technique online scammers use to draw in potential buyers. Common ploys include announcing a going-out-of-business sale or a sale to honor a late son, daughter, or grandmother. Newman said the people who assumed her company's name employed multiple versions of this gimmick, including having a close family member pass away. A customer who contacted Newman expressed sympathy for the loss of her son. I realized they thought I was the scam website, she said. So I was like, well, the good news is you haven't been scammed because I'm sending these products. But the bad news is you purchased from me thinking you were supporting somebody who's going through something hard. Murat Kantarcioglu, a computer science professor at Virginia Tech, recommends checking reviews before making any online purchases from smaller businesses. Customer reviews aren't always legitimate either, but they can be good to check as part of your research. Sites like the Better Business Bureau and UK-based Trustpilot are two places to look, as well as marketplaces like Amazon and Etsy if the brand has a presence there. If the small business claims to be there for 30 years, they should have reviews about them, maybe from at least a couple of years back. Another quick check is looking up where a website was registered. Kantarcioglu recommends doing a domain name search through the nonprofit Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. GoDaddy and Whois are other options. Or Whois, I'm sorry, Whois, Whois. That's another option. If a company claims to be in one country but is registered in another, that's a red flag. If the site was registered in the past few months but is marketed as belonging to established small business, that's another one. No matter how cautious you are, it's still possible to get scammed. If something seems off, it's better to hold off making a purchase than to make one you might regret. As artificial intelligence gets better, then scammers or people doing dubious business practice are going to have an easier time duping people because things are going to look more and more convincing, Keetron from the University of St. Thomas said. So every time tricks like these come out or publicity is generated around them, people that engage in these kinds of practices figure out ways of doing it that becomes more challenging to detect. Now from the opinion page, here's a letter to the editor of the Greeley Tribune from Ron Bars of Greeley. Donald Trump bullies everyone but Vladimir Putin. Ever wonder why? Donald Trump famously stated in his 2024 campaign that he could end the Russia-Ukraine war in 24 hours if he was elected. Most people were skeptical at best that Mr. Trump would be able to pull that off. After taking office, he admitted it wasn't going to be that easy. Of course, he hasn't succeeded in stopping the war, despite twice meeting in person with Putin and multiple meetings between various negotiators. On December 28th, Vladimir Zelensky met President Trump at Mar-a-Lago to discuss peace plans. Trump had spoken on the phone with Putin prior to this meeting. After the Trump-Zelensky meeting, President Trump gave an upbeat assessment of their talks. Then Putin and other Kremlin ministers accused Ukraine of drone attacks on Putin's Novgorod region residence. They didn't provide any clear-cut evidence of the attack. Trump's comments about the attack seemed to side with Putin. When it comes to other leaders, Trump has no hesitancy in berating them, even in public. One only has to watch his dress down of Zelensky in their February 2025 meeting in the White House on international TV. Listen to Trump's name-calling of his political opponents over the years. Sleepy Joe Biden, Pocahontas for Elizabeth Warren, Crooked Hillary Clinton, and Marjorie Traitor Greene. He also likes to insult journalists as fake news or the enemy of the people. He seems to like to target women, calling them piggy or terrible reporters. President Trump has no problem bullying international leaders like the United Nations. How about his threats to CBS about 60 Minutes and Harvard to withhold millions of federal funds? Yet with Putin, the Donald seems pretty powerless to exert any pressure. I'd have to say Putin has control of Trump. I wonder why. Don't you? That was a letter to the editor of the Tribune from Ron Bars of Greeley. We turn now to the obituary page. Sandra A. Asmus, age 83, of Greeley, passed away Friday, January 9, 2026, at Good Samaritan Water Valley Memory Care in Windsor, surrounded by her family. She was born September 24, 1942, in Jackson, Louisiana, to Grover Cleveland DeLong and Martha LeBlanc DeLong. She married Ronnie Asmus October 2, 1964, in Prairieville, Louisiana. Sandra grew up in Louisiana and perfected her Southern charm. After graduating from high school in 1960, she moved to Colorado, where she attended the University of Colorado Extension in Denver. One exceptional weekend, she went on a date with Ronnie, and soon after became his lovely bride. A few years after giving birth to daughter Rhonda, the family moved north to Greeley, where they settled and then welcomed daughter Sydney. Sandra was lovingly known by friends and family as a true domestic diva and a master shopper. Her passions included playing tennis and bridge, discovering and collecting antiques, and creating warm, welcoming gatherings. She had an exceptional talent for hosting with grace and style in her beautifully designed home. She was also a lifetime member of the St. Mary's Catholic Church and the Greeley Chapter of Questers, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the study, conservation, and preservation of historical objects for the benefit of today and tomorrow. Sandra is survived by her daughters Rhonda and her husband Bill Dudley of Estes Park, and Sydney Hagesath and her husband Mike Rice of Windsor. Grandchildren Patrick West, Taylor Dudley, Tucker Dudley, Hannah Hadley and Harper Hagesath, great-grandson Dax Dudley, brother Charles DeLone of San Lorenzo, California, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. She was preceded in death by her husband of 60 years, her parents, and five siblings, Marie Broad, Louise Cox, Ruth Wilson, Edward DeLone, and Harold DeLone. A private family burial will be held at a later date for Sandra to be laid to rest with Ronnie. The family wishes to extend our heartfelt gratitude to the memory care team at the Water Valley Good Samaritan Society in Windsor and Bloom Health Hospice. You have been amazing to all of us. Memorial contributions may be made in memory of Sandra to the Be Happy, Be Kind Foundation. Edward Lewis David, age 82, passed away peacefully on the morning of December 16, 2025, surrounded by his family. Eddie, also known as Sonny, was born on March 5, 1943, in Buffalo, New York. Eddie is survived by his beloved wife, Sue. They were married on February 23, 1963. His children, Ed and Julie David, Leona and Randy Ryan, Tracy and Gary McMorrow, and Felicia and Guy Burke. His two brothers, Louis David and Richard David, and two sisters, Elaine Hickson and Donna Bauer, and numerous grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and nieces and nephews. He'll be deeply missed by everyone who knew and loved him. Eddie honorably served his country in the U.S. Air Force for 20 years, retiring in 1981 from Lowry Air Force Base in Aurora. In 1983, Eddie transitioned into the oil industry and brought him to Greeley. Eddie was part owner of the P&P oil field And through the oil, though the oil field bust eventually led to its loss, Eddie and Sue opened S&E Industries. After 20 years, Eddie retired once again, this time to enjoy life on his fishing boat, the Sunny Sue. Eddie was famous for his fish tales, stories that got better with every telling. He loved fishing with many friends, but the most special times were the long hours spent on the water with his brother Louie. He had a way of keeping everyone hanging on his every word, never quite sure where the truth ended and the embellishment began. Eddie was known for his love of music and fun. He could spend hours recording albums onto cassette tapes, singing along, and creating trivia questions designed to stump anyone willing to play. He loved to dance, and some of the best memories were made during lively parties in the family basement. In his earlier years, Eddie was quite the pool shark and loved playing cards. He was an avid fan of the Denver Broncos. One of his favorite traditions was betting his brother Richie whenever the Broncos played the Buffalo Bills, a rivalry filled with laughter and plenty of good-natured trash talk. He leaves behind a legacy of laughter, confidence, passion, and unforgettable stories. There will be a celebration of Eddie's life set at a later date in March. For more information, you can contact Felicia Burke at 970-396-1139. That's 970-396-1139. Born in Manhattan, Kansas, Paul Salzman was the second of six children to Robert and Vivian Salzman. He spent much of his childhood in Greeley, where strong family ties and exposure to creativity helped shape his lifelong devotion to the arts and humanities. Paul attended Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas, following in the footsteps of his father. Initially drawn to writing and journalism, he ultimately found his calling in the theatrical arts after formative experiences on stage at Greeley Central High School. He became a classically trained Shakespearean actor, performing in over 70 stage productions. His work with the Marin Shakespeare Company garnered him critical acclaim in the Bay Area. Theater also brought Paul together with his life partner, Leanne, a classically trained stage actress. Together, they shared the stage and a deep admiration for Shakespeare's enduring insights into the human spirit. Paul was also a devoted ballroom dancer. He studied at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., and competed in England and Wales. For nearly two decades, he taught a vibrant dance community in Southern California. As a dedicated student of philosophy and cosmology, he will be missed for his depth of spirit, his precocious sense of humor, and his profound insights into what it means to be human. Paul is survived by his life partner, Leanne, his 91-year-old mother, four siblings, and an extended family. In memory of Paul, find your local community theater to experience the arts on stage, or spin, twirl, and whirl where you stand, and connect deeper with his legacy. Frank Michael Kolb, age 69, of Eaton, passed away on December 18, 2025, in Greeley. Frank was surrounded by love, leaving behind a legacy of service. Frank honorably served in the U.S. Coast Guard. A devoted husband and father, Frank cherished time with those he loved the most. He is survived by his wife of more than 30 years, Royce. His children, Ben Kolb, Wayman Barnett and his wife Elise, Andrew Kolb and his wife Leah Butler, and Joshua Barnett, eight grandchildren, and many siblings. Memorial contributions in Frank's name may be made to Tunnel to Towers in care of Lighthouse Family Mortuary, 3600 West 22nd Street in Greeley. A memorial service will be held this Saturday, January 24th at 10 a.m. at the First Church of the Nazarene, 2515 West 16th Street in Greeley. Larry Edward Frazier, a lifelong resident of Northern Colorado and a dedicated veteran, passed away on January 6, 2026, in Kersey, at the age of 83. Born on December 29, 1942, in Greeley, a proud veteran, he was drafted into the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. He was preceded in death by his wife, Sandra, his son John Kendrick, and his siblings Betty, Daniel, Darrell, Elizabeth, Norma, Harold, Edwin, and Donald. Larry is survived by his brothers, Ron, David, and Gary. His children, two unnamed daughters, Larry Frazier and Crystal Frazier. His grandchildren, John Kendrick, Jared Kendrick, Kayla Kendrick, and Snow Anna. And four great-grandchildren. Memorial services were held last Friday. Carol Marie Wheaton, age 85, of Greeley, departed this life on December 11, 2025. She was born March 16, 1940, in Indianola, Nebraska, to Zella Springer and Harold Coomer. Carol attended school at St. Patrick's Elementary, then McCook Public School. After graduation, she enrolled in the Beauty Academy in McCook. While being a beautician did not become her life's passion, it was a step toward meeting a tall, handsome man named Thomas Wheaton. She married Tom on February 23, 1960, and moved with him to San Diego, California. Carol and Tom had four children together, ultimately settling in La Salle, Colorado, where Carol tended to a large garden and had a vast collection of dolls. After her children were grown, Carol and Tom owned and operated Wheaton Trucking. This was a unique career for a woman at the time. They ran long-haul transit around the country, accompanied by their Scottish Terriers, until Tom's death in 1997. Carol later worked as a school bus driver and was affectionately known as Grandma Greenwood by many of the students, since her twin grandsons attended the school. For her personal car, she ultimately chose a vibrant orange Volkswagen Beetle, which she decorated with Gerber daisies and a Tweety bird on the dash. In later years, Carol cherished time with family. She loved a nice hike and road trips, as long as she was warm enough. She accumulated a stylish collection of vests and coats and could often be seen with earmuffs, just in case. A talented seamstress throughout her life, Carol was the mind and hands behind many of the outfits her children and grandchildren sport in their most memorable childhood photos. Carol is survived by her son, Thomas II, and his wife, Holly Wheaton, of Ward, two daughters, Sherry Kuhl of Hartley, Iowa, and her husband, Gary, and Kelly Greenwood of Greeley and her husband, Kurt, her sisters-in-law, Ray White of Hagler, Nebraska, and Patricia Parker of Colby, Kansas, a dear cousin, Rita Coomer, 10 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, many other cousins, nieces, a nephew, and friends. Carol was preceded in death by her husband Thomas, her daughter Pamela Macy, and her son-in-law Tim Macy, her sister Shirley Redeker, a beloved aunt Teresa Stratman, and a grandson Jeremiah Wheaton. A visitation was held over this past weekend. Suzanne Ellis Carter passed away Monday, December 29, 2025. Her memorial is tentatively scheduled for Saturday, April 11th at 1 p.m. at Atonement Lutheran Church in Boulder. A private graveside interment will be held later that same day. Sue was born in Beech Grove, Indiana, November 27, 1934, graduated from Banning High School in Banning, California, 1952, then graduated with her bachelor's degree in speech pathology and hearing audiology from Redlands University in California in 1956. She graduated with her master's degree in hearing audiology from CU in Boulder in 1972. She met and married her amazing husband, Ken, in the summer of 65. Together, they raised seven children at Eagle Bird Ranch in Boulder. Sue enjoyed traveling, snorkeling, spending time with her family, and was an avid reader. She was the mentor of her children and grandchildren, the matriarch of her family. She worked as an audiologist with the Westminster School District for many years, followed by work as a surgical assistant at Boulder Ear, Nose, and Throat Clinic, before opening her own private practice as an audiologist, where she led a volunteer hearing clinic every school year for the Navajo Reservation at Four Corners. Sue is survived by her six remaining children, Susan, Robert, Stephen, Jay, Kay, and Jennifer, along with 17 grandchildren, 33 great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. And on that note, we must conclude as our time has expired. My name's Mike Fierberg. I appreciate your spending some time with us and hearing stories from the Greeley Tribune. And I look forward to reading to you again next week.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Greeley Tribune, please contact them directly at letters@greeleytribune.com or call 970-352-0211.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.